affected by that. And a new one now has just cropped up just a little bit north of Regency Mall, affecting 5 customers. Just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's take a look at WGTD sports and weather, shall we? NBA, the Bucks were off last night. The Bulls beat Miami 105-89. The Bucks play in Toronto tonight, and the Bulls are off. NHL, Blackhawks off last night. They're off again tonight. College basketball, number 10 Marquette beat Butler 76-58. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Thursday, January 31st. The wind chill warning stays in effect till noon today. A sunny morning, a cloudy afternoon, 50% chance of afternoon snow. Today's high 3 below, wind chills between 38 and 48 below. Tonight, about an inch of snow, overnight low 4 below zero. Warm up begins tomorrow, Friday 20 degrees, Saturday 38 degrees, Sunday and Monday in the 40s with rain. Right now, 24 below Racine, 23 below Kenosha. Wind from the north at 3. Wind chill now stands at 40 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available now online at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer.
Tomorrow night at Carthage, a brand new musical is opening, and this is a world premiere of a show called My Real Mother. And I'm very, very excited to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, first of all, with the director of this production, Maggie Spanuello, who is a Carthage grad of just over a decade ago and now part of the music faculty, music theater faculty at Carthage, the director of this production. And we also have with us in the studios Riley Thomas, who is the composer and librettist of this brand new show based on a book called Open, an adoption story in 3 voices. These performances will be coming up in what's called the V-PAL at Carthage Friday and Saturday nights and Sunday afternoon. Maggie Spanuello and Riley Thomas, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Great to be having you here. Thank you for making time and for journeying here on a very, very cold day to talk about this exciting project. Maggie, maybe you could say a word about how this commission, this work has been commissioned by Carthage, how this project came about in the first place.
Absolutely. We are always looking for pieces at Carthage for our music theater workshop that really highlight the students that we have in the program at that moment. And when we were looking forward to this January, we knew we would have a lot of women, especially a lot of junior women who would need roles and need an opportunity to shine and attack, you know, a character or attack a certain type of a musical that they haven't yet. And when I was taking all of those things into account, as I think that we often are right now in music theater, we're falling short when we're looking for musicals with lots of women.
I just want to interject. I just saw the musical 9 up in Milwaukee, and this is this particular production had 9 women and 1 man. And I know one thing that excites people about this particular show is that there are all these meeting roles for women, and so often it's tilted the opposite way, and it's frustrating.
Absolutely. I mean, it is, you know, the musicals like 9 that, yes, you get the one part, you get that, you know, your feature in that moment. It doesn't necessarily carry throughout the entire script.
Right.
But yeah, it is a lovely opportunity to cast a lot of women and not have to look for a lot of men.
Right. So this commission sprang out of having all of this talent at Carthage and wondering what kind of a show can we give them that would give plenty of showcases for all of these talented students.
Absolutely. And I posted on Facebook, because that's what you do when you need to complain about something. And Riley commented, and said, well, I could just write you a musical. And I started messaging him, and Riley and I have known each other since we were teenagers. And I said, you know, I don't think that that's a bad idea. You know, what do you have for a lot of women? And so he and I started the conversation there, and he had this musical in the works in his brain, but also sort of on paper. And so we decided that it was going to be that show for us this J term.
Wow. And I don't think I really sufficiently said this, but Riley Thomas already has a couple of much discussed musicals to his credit, Wearing Black and Stuck, and now My Real Mother. Just say a quick word about how the two of you knew each other. Did you go to the same high schools down in Illinois?
No, we went to the same middle school.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so we've known each other since middle school. Our first show together was Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
So you performed together?
Yeah.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
We grew up doing musicals together, summer theater and whatnot.
Fantastic. So you've been in some contact ever since?
In some contact ever since. Certainly, you know, following each other in a friendly way on Facebook. But we have never collaborated since, you know.
Meg has been more of a Midwest girl, and I've kind of been in New York for the past 10 years. So, like, our paths haven't intersected that much. So it's an exciting opportunity to come and work with somebody that you've known for so long.
Absolutely. So, Riley, as is sometimes the case with composers in the realm of musical theater, did you first aspire to actually be on the stage more as a performer? And then did you make a shift over towards composing?
I think I did when I was younger, because when you're a kid or a preteen or a teenager, when you see a piece of work, pretty much what you're seeing is the performers. So you think, oh, I want to be a part of that. And all that really occurs to you is to be an actor, because that's what you see.
Right.
And then as I got older, I realized that as an actor, the only tool you have to tell a story is yourself. And as a director, you have what's given to you. But as a writer, you get to create whatever you want. And I realized that I was super greedy and wanted all the control. So that's why I became a writer.
Very good. Did you study this in college? I mean, composing? Or at that point, was this still not a serious aspiration for you?
Honestly, it wasn't a serious aspiration in college. I did study music theater and music, so I got a little bit of background in theater and music in college. But it wasn't until I was out of college that I decided to pursue writing at all. So I'm predominantly self-taught when it comes to that. I took a lot of extra master classes. I read a bunch. I saw everything that I could. So that's pretty much how I've taught myself.
What was it like to do those first couple efforts in which you're actually sitting down and composing something, not just for your own amusement, but sharing it, maybe not quite with the wide world yet, but I mean, the first time you started really expressing yourself as a composer, did that feel like you were stepping out on a limb or stepping off a cliff, or what was that like?
It's an interesting combination of feeling perfectly natural and perfectly confused at the same time. There were times when it felt like it wasn't even me creating something, that it was just coming through me. And then there were other times where it really felt like I was laying pieces brick by brick. So it's definitely an odd combination of, oh, this is where I belong, but I've got a lot of work to do.
Mm. I believe I saw in your resume that you are production coordinator for the Broadway Bound Theater Festival.
Yes.
So is that, in a sense, your day job, and then you find whatever time you can on the side to feed this other passion?
Well, I would say that is definitely a seasonal job. That goes up in the summer. Mm. And so during like submission season, which actually starts around now, there's reading the submissions and help curating the season. And then during the summer, there's liaisoning with the specific shows within the festival to make sure that they are meeting specifications and guidelines and offering assistance in that way. So it's definitely more of a seasonal job and not your traditional 9-to-5 day job that one would have. And in this business, you really have to sort of find work where you can.
Sure.
And fill the holes. And that's something that I'm very passionate about, is help create new work.
Right. Cobbling things together and building what's quite an exciting life for you. So what is your process like, for instance, with the previous two works? Let's talk about them first. Your musicals Stuck and Wearing Black. And we should mention that Stuck has actually been adapted into a film that I hope I get to see someday. you're both the composer and the librettist. I mean, you're responsible for the book and the score.
Correct. As I said before, I'm pretty greedy.
So how does this work then for you? I mean, typically when you're creating a substantial work like a musical, like My Real Mother, which we'll get to in a second, typically what is this process like? Where does it start and where does it take you from there?
Sure. It definitely starts with an idea. Everything comes from sort of the genesis of this idea of what are the themes and overarching universalities that I'm trying to tackle or communicate in whatever work of art. So, for instance, in Stuck, it's very much about identity and looking deeper and trying to find the connections that bind us all within our similarities. That's like the themes behind Stuck. So the genesis of that idea is what starts. And then I'm like, well, how do I craft a story around that idea? Who are the characters? How does everything tie into that theme? And then I build the plot from there. What are the plot points that I need to hit in order to really support this theme? And then once that whole plot idea is established, I start breaking it down into scenes and songs, and you sort of go from there and fill in. So for me, it's very much top down. And sometimes the idea can come from anywhere. For instance, I got stuck on the train one day and I was looking around and I was like, nowhere else in the world are people of such different walks of life in the same spot at the same time with the same goal. And that was so exciting to me. And I started making up stories for everyone that I was seeing. And great. I realized that it would be a good musical idea.
Right. So this is the musical Stuck. I think six passengers who are inexplicably stuck in a train car.
Correct.
In New York City, I would presume. And from what I've seen of the trailer of the film, it looks like a great, great show and sounds like a great show
as well.
So this invitation of sorts comes from Maggie Spanuelo for you to create something for Carthage. Have you ever had an invitation like that before?
No. This is a world premiere for me as well in terms of an opportunity.
Very good. So how long did it I want to make sure I give you time to tell the interesting story of how you heard about the book that this is based upon, Open, an adoption story in three voices. I love this story.
Everything about this, the genesis of this musical has been wonderfully serendipitous. I was getting a haircut one day and struck up a conversation with a hairstylist who was telling me that she had just released this book about how she gave her child up for adoption. And the book sort of chronicles her long relationship with the woman who adopted her child. And it's a very interesting and unique relationship that she was telling me about. And as a child of adoption myself, I resonated with the story and I was like, I would love to read that book. So she just happened to have a copy and she gave it to me. And I read it and instantly connected with the story and reached out to her and was like, I would love to adapt this into a musical.
Wow.
And they were thrilled.
I believe your previous musicals were entirely original, not based on any pre-existent work
Correct.
At all. How different did it feel to be adapting something that already was in the world, and in particular, although I don't know how closely you adhere to the original book, but the book, of course, is about very real people. So did this feel strange to, in a sense, be in the world of nonfiction instead of fiction?
It absolutely felt strange. When you're creating something wholly original, you have the freedom to mess with personalities in order to support the story however you want. When I'm adapting something, I try to stay as true as I can to the source material. And I suppose Maggie can say whether or not I've done that more successfully than I can. But it's nerve-wracking adapting real people because you want to do them justice and you don't want to warp who they are. So I definitely kept that as close as I can to the center of my motivation in order to adhere to that. That being said, I have morphed things very slightly here and there to try and fit the dramatic story arc a little bit better. But on the whole, I'd say I'm very faithful to the source material.
Right. Does that sound right, Maggie? And have you read the book that he's talking about?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I read it last year. I would say that I'm the one that's sort of, asking, can we make Jason a guitar teacher instead of a piano teacher because that's easier for my blocking. I'm the one trying to take a few liberties with some things from the book. There's one moment where Elena puts her hands on Alex's stomach when they first meet. I'm reversing that in the blocking. So there's a few moments that are not, you know, point by point, but overall, it is, I think it's a very honest and wonderful depiction of what they set out to say in the book, which was often a very, you know, painful admission of how they felt in, you know, surrounding this adoption and sharing this daughter of theirs. And there's a lot of pain in there that we're able to get in a musical, which is not usually something that you want to dwell on in music theater. You know, you want to be funny and you want to celebrate joy. And we're able to do all of that. The first time I read the script, I was shocked at how much of the book was actually in the script. You know, you're trying to make a musical 2 hours long and you've got a real long book and three different viewpoints, and you're translating that into hopefully like a 2 hour musical written by one voice. And so I think that we did a really good job.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Maggie Spanarello and Riley Thomas, director and composer librettist, respectively, of a brand new work receiving its world premiere at Carthage College this weekend, Friday and Saturday evenings and Sunday afternoon in the VPAL. The work is called My Real Mother, based upon a book called Open, an adoption story in three voices. One of the things I was most curious about was just how collaborative this process was in creating My Real Mother, and we're already getting a sense that it was quite collaborative. So how did this musical take shape for you, Riley, and at what points were you sharing things with Maggie and receiving her input and so on?
Probably, I'm definitely somebody who likes to go off in my own little corner and work on something until I have something that I feel is good enough to share. So I was not sharing stuff with Maggie nearly as early as I would have wanted to, because I'm a little bit of a perfectionist. But getting her input on story ideas and how the plot points play out was important to me. So I tried to share that as much as I could, even though I definitely could have shared more. But the working with the process of rehearsing the show and coming up with the emotional moments has been extremely collaborative in the rehearsal process.
When did this process begin?
Which part of the process?
Well, first of all, the little Facebook exchange. How long ago was that?
Probably last January.
Yeah.
Maybe a full year ago.
Oh, okay. And in terms of shaping this work into exactly what would be most useful for the Carthage musical theater program, did you already know who you were specifically writing for in terms of particular students with particular voices, or was it not collaborative to that extent?
At the beginning, I didn't know specifically who I would be writing for, more that we're interested in developing a musical with lots of female characters, like Maggie already said, who have meaty roles and things to tackle. It wasn't until later in the process where I got sent, you know, videos and profiles of the characters that I was writing, or of the actors who would be playing the characters. And that definitely helped me tailor things a little bit more towards them.
And when roughly did that happen, Maggie?
Casting happened in November. So
This past November.
Oh, wow. Absolutely.
So a lot had already taken shape before casting occurred.
Yeah, songs had been written, and you know, Act One had been written. One thing that we really wanted to change, again, to keep more female characters in it, the adoption lawyer in the book is a man named Jack, who we have a woman playing her, and her name is now Jackie. So, you know, one small adjustment that we've made in the world of the music theater version of Open. So that was the, you know, only real adjustment that had to be made from the script that we were given. I really wanted to make sure that we had roles for women. The older son is being played by a woman, but as a man. So we have Darian Hiller, who is a senior, and she is playing Christian with, you know, with a hat on, like a boy.
She's hysterical.
And she's great. I almost think that the role should be played that way.
I'm open to it, for sure.
Interesting. So, Riley, when you're composing, are you apt to share something you're writing with anybody? Or
no.
So in this case, I mean, as this was taking shape, the only two people in the world who knew anything about this was you and Maggie.
Pretty much.
Wow. Interesting. Because I know some composers really feel like, for whatever reason, feel a compulsion almost to share something and get tons of feedback from might be mentors or teachers or colleagues or whatever. And it sounds like that's just not the way you're wired, which is fine.
It depends. I do take feedback and want feedback, but there's a specific group of people that I trust. And usually with something like this, part of doing a world premiere is crafting a story and then getting feedback in that sense. Because at least at this point, when you get to put on a show, I get to say, this is what I meant. Now what do you think?
Hmm.
As opposed to getting all of this feedback and getting confused about your original intention.
Right.
So for me, there's a time and a place for when I want feedback and a specific group of people that I go to so that there's not too many cooks in the kitchen. And I'm not getting too many dissenting opinions.
Right. That's wise, I should think. Do you view this in a sense as what some people might refer to as your Boston? That is a show that you're opening in Boston or Philadelphia or Chicago, and as sort of a almost like a trial run, a workshop in which let's see how this works and then let's take it apart and make it even better? Or have you really approached this as though this is the work, and when it opens, this is the work, period? And then if the opportunity arises, you would love to share it with the world as it is. Have you thought much about that?
I have thought much about that, and it's more of the former. I'm always open to rewriting things and making the piece stronger as how it works. That being said, an awful amount of thought goes into every moment, so I'm not just willy-nilly changing things because people think I should. I need to be convinced as to why an idea is better, and I'm happy to be convinced. But so it's definitely more the former.
What has your role been, for instance, this January, as this production has actually taken shape? And Maggie, feel free to chime in with how you've seen his role, but how have you seen your role, Riley?
Sure. In rehearsals, I'm definitely more the music director, and that's pretty much it. I try to stay as hands-off as I can, because I think it's important to, as a writer, step back and leave room for collaboration with other artists, because that's the magic and beauty of theater. Mm. And Maggie's has all these brilliant ideas that she adds to the script that I didn't even realize could be there. And that's what I love about not directing my own work and standing back and letting somebody else do it. Mm.
Do you have any direct musical hand at all? I mean, like, are you at the keyboard or will you be in the audience?
I'm going to be in the audience, which is really exciting. We have an accompanist who I've been working with to sort of create the sound of the show. And we're going to have a percussionist as well, which is really exciting. So that's another thing that is important to me, is to be able to step back and not be involved so that I can watch and learn as a writer.
Hmm. That reminds me of something you said in an interview, that your advice for young composers is finish.
Yes.
And then get that work out there so you can see what the world has to say about it, and that's the only way you learn.
Yeah.
And so as long as it's in your drawer of your desk, you don't learn anything from it.
Nope.
Yeah. Maggie, what has this collaboration been like for you? I'm thinking especially during January, and what has it been like for you and for your students?
Sure. I have never directed a world premiere musical before, ever. So it's a completely different animal.
Hmm.
Part of being a director is doing the research on past productions.
Right.
Knowing how it's been received, you know, understanding productions that have existed, how they've succeeded or how they have not. And you don't have any of that information with a new musical. So every option is out there. You know, you can go in whatever way that you want. It's lovely having Riley in the room, because if there's ever a moment that is confusing for me, I can ask about it. I don't need to go that map all by my, do that map all by myself, I have the writer in the room. And we do often ask him, you know, how does the character get to this point at this moment? You know, can you track that for me? Why does this line make sense here? And I can only assume that it must be thrilling to watch someone else read your story and then tell that story in their own way. You know, Riley writes it and, you know, writes the music and then hands it over to a director who reads it and puts it through her own Dr. Seuss machine and has it come out on stage. And, you know, there are many moments that have caught Riley by surprise. And
absolutely.
There have been many moments that, you know, I have caught myself by surprise that things have worked out or, you know, the story is as clear as I think it is. So it's lovely having Riley in the room. And it, although it's different because you don't have any point of reference for directing a world premiere musical, you know, it's, you're still telling a story and you're still doing the best job that you can and you're still finding your own personal connections with the script and why this story is important for you to tell and why the audience needs to hear it and why the world needs to hear it. And so, you know, once you have that in with the script, it really does become your own, no matter how many other productions have happened.
And I'm sure this has been an amazing and thrilling experience for the students to be working with the composer himself in the room.
This is probably the hardest thing they've ever had to do because, you know, they too have not been able to watch YouTube videos. Our choreographer has not been able to, you know, see what the dance looked like on Broadway. We're all working from a clean slate, and that's not necessarily what we're teaching. You know, at Carthage in the music theater program, a lot of it, you know, all of our rep is all, it's not new, it's all existing repertoire. This is the first new musical we've ever done. We usually do existing musicals. Even classes like I teach music theater history and how I'm always coming from a place of you can't have art that's not affected by anything. So where did we get what we're doing right now? You know, studying vaudeville, studying the Golden Age, studying contemporary music theater, trying to find what links all of these pieces together. So our entire pedagogy is about, you know, what has happened before and how does that affect now? And really throwing them in the frying pan on that and making them do a new show that has never been done, that they really have to do their homework on. It's the hardest thing that they've ever done, but they are loving it.
That's what I hear. And I know a lot of people are just tremendously excited to experience this for themselves. So the performances are Friday night, Saturday night, 7:30, and Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock in Carthage's VPAL, which is right next to the Art Gallery and Recital Center, a recital hall, and kind of an interesting plain space in some respects, which makes it very versatile. And also, when you're really launching a brand new work, I should think it's a really nice, clean framework within which to see something for the first time.
Absolutely. You know, when we started, you know, this show, when it goes to Broadway, will be probably in a proscenium. But the VPAL doesn't really work like that. We don't necessarily want to do a proscenium. We always end up doing something in the Thrust or something in the Round. And we're in a very sort of, would you call it like an alley deep thrust?
it's an alley thrust is what I'm calling it.
It's an alley thrust, which is also another setup that we haven't had in a long time in the VPAL. We've never had such a narrow acting space. So the students also get to figure out the complexities of that as well at the same time while doing a brand new musical.
Wow. And
a beautiful,
Riley,
intimate way to tell a story. You can really get into the emotional moments from every angle,
right?
Which is really exciting.
And this is, of course, exactly that kind of story, deeply personal on so many levels. So,
and that's why I wanted to tell it. That's why I responded to it. It's such a beautiful, emotional, unique story about something that we don't really talk about. Adoption is still a little bit taboo. The relationship between these two women, is kind of uncharted. And that, to me, is what makes a good musical, something that's new and exciting, but ultimately is about family and is about love and is about connection.
Wonderful. The show, again, My Real Mother, being performed this weekend, receiving its world premiere, a work commissioned by Carthage College by composer and playwright Riley Thomas, the director Maggie Spunwello. My thanks to both of you and very, very best wishes for a successful run of My Real Mother.
Thank you
very much.
And in an interesting note, due to the extremely cold weather, classes were canceled at Carthage Wednesday and Thursday, the last 2 days of J-term. And fortunately, the cast of My Real Mother was granted, in a sense, a special dispensation to be able to continue work on this musical, and the performances will go on this weekend as scheduled. So again, performances are Friday evening and Saturday evening, 7:30, and Sunday afternoon, I believe at 3. And if you would like to purchase a ticket, you can call the Fine Arts box office, 551-6661. I'm not sure you'll get an answer today. You might want to think about calling tomorrow instead. Otherwise, you can also go online to www.carthage.edu/fineArts/box office. Again, www.carthage.edu/fineArts/box office. And actually, if you go to the Carthage website, carthage.edu, and click on the link which is called The Bridge, that gives you a nice rundown of all kinds of different events that are going on. And if you click on the pertinent dates for these performances of My Real Mother, the story includes all of the links and information that you need for purchasing tickets. And my thanks again to Maggie Spunwello and Riley Thomas for joining me in part one of today's morning show. Here is part two of today's program at 19 minutes before 9 o'clock. Well, as someone who owns and loves two golden retrievers, I am a dog lover from way back, and so it is with special pleasure that I am welcoming to this portion of the morning show someone who is also a dog lover, a woman by the name of Nancy Furstinger, who is also a highly acclaimed author and editor of children's books and responsible for a wonderful new book that has just been published by National Geographic, primarily intended for young readers, but just about anybody is going to be inspired by this book called Paws of Courage, True Tales of Heroic Dogs That Protect and Serve. In this book, Nancy Furstinger highlights the inspiring stories of more than 20 different work dogs or service dogs who have done work of one kind or another to make the world a better place. And in particular, she focuses on military and law enforcement dogs who, in a sense, face great peril and often make a very, very dramatic difference for the better in very, very difficult situations. And I'm really happy to have Nancy Furstinger with me on the phone to talk about this book, which is her first book for National Geographic. Nancy Furstinger, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. And I, too, am very passionate about dogs. I have two rescued dogs myself. And I was really thrilled to profile these 22 dogs that star in Paws of Courage. And it was incredible the number of jobs that they do. Because you probably know that dogs' noses are far superior than human noses. They are 10,000 times more powerful. Dogs can even detect 1 teaspoon of sugar in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. So that's amazing.
Right. What they can do is really, really something. I know that you not only have dogs, but I think you have other animals as well. I mean, you are not just a dog lover, but an animal lover. Just give our listeners a sense of just who lives at your home.
Well, I have a 130-pound Rottweiler named Bosco, who's just a big mush. I have a rescued Lab Shepherd Rhodesian Ridgeback Hound mix, who comes from North Carolina, Rosie. And then I have a quartet of rescued house rabbits, who mostly come from the local SPCA, where I volunteer with the rabbits primarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, you obviously not only love animals, but you love writing. And in particular, you seem to have spent most of your professional energies on helping to develop and edit children's books. Can you just say a quick word about where that interest came from?
Yes, actually, I was an editor at Simon & Schuster for three different imprints that are now all defunct, unfortunately. But I read a couple of books, in particular, one by Fergie, the Duchess, and it was really awful, and I challenged myself to write a better book, and that's how I started out. And I slowly became known as a author who specializes in animal topics, which, as you can probably tell, are my passion. So most of my books are animal subjects, particularly this one, which National Geographic actually approached me and asked me if I would write a book about hero dogs. And that was the tentative title of the book, but I'm sure you agree that Paws of Courage is a much more appealing title.
Oh, I think it's great.
So
By the way, I've seen two different indications of just how young a reader this book is intended for. One place I saw that it was for readers 10 and up, but someplace else it was indicated as for readers 5 and up. And not that those specifics necessarily matter, but it prompts the question of what sort of a reader were you thinking about as you wrote this book, and how tricky is it to craft a book that a lot of different young readers are going to be able to understand and appreciate and enjoy?
That's a great question. The ages 10 and up is the correct specification from National Geographic, and of course, a lot of adults also enjoy this book, but this book is geared toward reluctant readers because it's got brief text and short chapters. It's easy to manage, a lot of action photos. So I'm hoping that a lot of young males who don't particularly enjoy books will pick it up. But it's a whole different story if you craft a book for, say, a five-year-old, which I have two picture books, both about animals as well. The text is much briefer, usually 1,000 words or less, a couple of sentences per page, and it's very heavily influenced by the artwork or in some cases photographs. Which this book, being a National Geographic book, their hallmark is fantastic action photos, which I think they've really captured in this book.
We're speaking with Nancy Furstinger, and we're talking about her book, Paws of Courage, True Tales of Heroic Dogs That Protect and Serve. This is a book for young readers primarily, although anybody of just about any age is going to enjoy this book on some different level. And this is Nancy Furstinger's first book for National Geographic. So give our listeners some sense of the array of jobs that a work dog can do. I mean, and it goes beyond sort of the obvious or the most noteworthy, which most people have probably heard at least a little bit about. Give us a sense of what that array of possibilities, in fact, is, and how much of that scope is covered in your book.
Yes, I'll be happy to. As I said, dogs' noses are 10,000 times more powerful than humans, which they can sniff out practically anything with those noses. Some of them become explosive detection dogs overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. Others you might have seen at an international airport. They sniff out food and drugs and other illegal contraband. Other canine companions that are paired with police officers are great at apprehending suspects. Dogs can go to a training program up in Maine that an insurance company started to detect the accelerants used in arson, such as gasoline. And then I have some dogs that do jobs that you would never think of. One in particular in Italy jumps out of helicopters to rescue swimmers in distress along the coast. Two in Africa help track down poachers who are hunting African elephants. There's dogs that sniff out invasive species such as pythons in the Everglades. Other dogs that sniff out tiger scat to track down, you know, rare species that need protection. It just goes on and on. Bed bugs, they can sniff out cancer. They can smell when someone is about to have an epileptic seizure. I could go on for another 5 minutes.
Wow, it's really amazing. When it comes to a particular task, I mean, one of those tasks that you just enumerated, are we typically talking about a certain breed of dog that is especially well-suited for that particular task? Or typically could just about any breed of dog handle just about any of these various tasks that you were just listing?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the most preferred dog overseas to become a military working dog is the Belgian Malinois, like Leica, who stars on the cover. They look like smaller versions of German Shepherds, and these are the canine superheroes. They're combined speed, strength, and courage. Police dogs are still primarily German Shepherds because they're loyal and confident. And search and rescue dogs are retrievers, like your golden retrievers. They're intelligent, energetic, and strong. The dogs that you see in airports are usually smaller with a great nose, such as a beagle. And for the arson dogs, I found this really fascinating. The insurance company that trains these dogs to sniff out accelerants rescues these dogs from shelters, and they go into the shelters and they look for primarily lab and lab mixes, and they're looking for the dogs that bounce off the walls with excess amount of energy because they harness that high energy and they direct it into the job. So it's a great program because they rescue a lot of dogs that would otherwise, you know, not have a chance at getting a home.
You're touching on already on the next question I wanted to ask, which is, for instance, when there is a task to be done and one has a sense of a particular breed that is especially ideal, let's say, for instance, a golden retriever who might be engaged in you know, kind of a search and rescue sort of thing. Once we know that that's the task and we probably want a golden retriever or some kind of retriever to do that, then what difference is there between, for instance, various golden retrievers or black labs or whatever we might be looking at in terms of particular dogs who would be especially good at this particular sort of work? I mean, are there certain things that one would want to look for?
Well, they want a dog who's very enthusiastic about the task they're about to perform and one with the right personality. For instance, I can tell you a little bit about Brittany, who is a golden retriever who is in the book and was recently in a lot of news stories your listeners might have heard. She was the last remaining 9/11 dog, and she had three careers in her life. She trained to become a search and rescue dog because she had the right temperament and she was very energetic. And she was about 2 years old when she and her handler, Denise Corliss, went on their first search and rescue deployment. And this was baptism by fire because it was 9/11, the very first time she went out on the job. And unfortunately, she wasn't able to do what she was trained for, search and rescue. But she noticed a firefighter sitting there very dejected with his head in his hands. And she tugged Denise over and put her head in his lap to cheer him up. And she instantly transformed into a therapy dog. So during the entire 2 weeks she was there in Manhattan, she offered comfort to people. And she had a great personality like most golden retrievers. She was confident and calm in stressful situations. And she did end up working a lot of search and rescues, including Hurricane Katrina. And then she became older, and she transformed once again into another job. She became a reading dog with first graders. She went into schools and had first graders read books to her, because a lot of kids are not confident readers, and they don't want to read a book in front of their peers, but they'll gladly read a book to a handsome dog. And earlier this month, she passed away. She was the last 9/11 dog, and she was nearly 17, which is quite an amazing age for a golden retriever.
Wow, that's quite a story. What kind of training is involved in getting a dog ready to do some of these challenging tasks? And once a dog has been trained, are they sort of trained in perpetuity, or do dogs, in a sense, need to have that training refreshed through the course of the time that they are doing the work?
Well, that's a good question. It really depends on the task that they're being trained to do. For instance, a lot of these military working dogs are trained overseas in Israel or other places by professional dog trainers, whereas search and rescue dogs are trained on simulated rubble piles here. And what I found out, which was really amazing, is that one of the top rewards for training a dog is a Kong toy on a rope. And in case your listeners aren't familiar, it's a big rubber toy with a hollow in the middle that you can stuff with peanut butter. It bounces, it floats. Dogs just love it. So they use that as a reward for the dogs to find explosives, and that's how they initially train the dog. They have the scent of the explosive in the Kong, and once the dog associates the scent with the Kong, he knows he'll get his reward afterwards, playtime. So then they gradually transition over and just have the scent by itself, and then the dog is rewarded with the Kong. And they use this also for dogs who detect accelerants for arson, very similar situation. So I also found out that there's two types of an alert these dogs are trained to give. For instance, if a dog is apprehending a criminal and sniffs out drugs in the car, the dog will dig and paw at the car. The paint chips will fly. But obviously, that's not a good way to alert if a dog sniffs out a bomb. So in that instance, it could be disastrous. He will just sit and point his nose toward where the bomb is.
Wow. It's amazing to think about dogs being able to do their tasks with that sort of precision and correctness. I'm thinking about our older golden retriever who's 13 and has both failing eyesight and failing hearing especially. But as far as we can tell, there's nothing yet wrong with her nose. She still seems to have a very, very good sense of smell. For the typical work dog doing this work for the military and law enforcement, what typically are the issues which lead to that dog having to retire from their work?
Well, because of it, because the work is so grueling, a lot of these dogs retire when they're 7 or 8 years old. 90% of the military working dogs are adopted by their trainers, and the other 10% are adopted out to carefully screen civilians, which there's a very long waiting list. I already checked. Sometimes dogs have injuries, like Leica, the dog on the cover. She was sniffing out an explosive. She was only on the job for 3 weeks. She was in Afghanistan, and she was leading her trainer, Julie McDonald, and his team, and a sniper shot her, and she lost her right front leg. So she went through many operations, and she was retired, but they were very the military was reluctant to give her to her trainer, who by this time was also retired. And he convinced them that, you know, she would transform into a great family dog because he had a wife and a toddler. And with, you know, she went through a desensitization program, and he had a muzzle on her when she first met his young son, and he took it off after 5 minutes. She's perfectly fine. She's a real family dog. She does all kinds of activities with them, such as kayaking, and he actually refers to her as his fur daughter.
Uh-huh.
And